Maybe you've had a bad experience or two with a boss at work, or conversely, you worked for someone who was a dream to be around, someone who knew the needs of organization and individuals and blended those smoothly and seamlessly. There are lots of resources to make managers better in today's world, not just management training, but a whole realm of study and thought in academia. Our next guest studies the things that makes good managers good. Kate Zappe is an assistant professor of management in the Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon. She's this month's guest in our regular segment with the University of Oregon, Curious, Research Meets Radio. Kate Zappe, welcome.
Thank you. This is a fun way to start my Monday morning.
Oh, good. Am I pronouncing your last name correctly?
Yeah, I think so. It's my married name, and it took me a couple years to figure it out, so it sounded right to me.
Okay. Well, then we'll sort of struggle with it together. Okay.
Perfect.
Just at the outset, Dr. Zappe, is this field a bottomless pit? It seems like with psychology and business practices and more in there, you could study management for a lifetime and feel like you haven't scratched the surface.
Absolutely. There is so much that we still don't know, as with most social sciences. So I was listening to another podcast that was from biology, and they seem so certain in their findings, and I never get to enjoy that level of certainty because there's so much more that we can add to the equation because people are really complicated, and people are what makes up our workplaces.
So what kinds of things, I'm curious now, when you're studying management, what sorts of prerequisites? I mean, do you have to take courses in psychology, sociology, anthropology, things like that?
Yes. So my area of research is organizational behavior, and you could probably call it the psychology of work. So most of the theories that I draw from and the courses and things I was reading through my doctoral program are all really rooted in psychology or sociology and related areas there.
So I wonder about organizational behavior then, whether organizations are predictably like people or like the people who run them, or if they are very different from people, I mean, just at the outset.
Well, for the most part, they're made up in some way of the people that are in the organization. So sometimes if it's a smaller organization, it looks more like that founder. They had a vision. Their personality kind of infuses that work environment. But it can also be influenced kind of from a bottom up, depending on who's interacting, who has kind of informal or formal status and power. And so it functions like people in many ways, but it's a function of the people that make up that organization.
All right. The components are certainly going to make a different whole for sure. Just in terms of general management theory, because I'm sure a lot of employees wonder about this, can anyone be an effective manager?
Well, I will say anyone can be an effective leader. I will expand it beyond just managers, because sometimes the things that we need out of good leaders don't always come with the title of manager. But these are things that we can work on, that we can build skills from. There are personality components, like being more extroverted or being very conscientious, that make these things more possible. But certainly anybody can start to think about how to effectively interact with people, inspire people. It takes some personal resources to decide to handle situations with care and thought. And we know we have bosses that don't always do that. But it's in all of us to be better employees, better managers, better leaders.
So I guess you'd resist the idea that people are born to be managers, but it sounds like some people are just more natural and it comes more easily to them.
Sure. So some people have are more comfortable in some of the things that make up a good leader. And so whether it's you kind of naturally have a little bit more self-esteem or self-efficacy so you can speak up more quickly, or some people have higher emotional intelligence, and that's really critical to interacting with other people at work, being able to understand how they might be feeling, what might help resolve or amplify a positive feeling or resolve a negative feeling. And so some of us are just more intuitively better at that. But these things we're finding vary day-to-day. Even our personalities can vary on a day-to-day basis. So we have a baseline, but there's room to grow and change.
It seems like throughout the history of people having managers, which is pretty much the history of human beings, I'm sure, that people will get promoted to be bosses because they do certain jobs well. And I wonder, in this age of MBA programs and management training all over the place, does that happen less often now?
That's interesting. I'm not sure. What I can say is that we have a lot of different generations in our workplace right now, and we have a lot of different views on what should get rewarded. And so some people in organizations might view tenure and commitment as the most rewardable function or promotable, but we see more and more that organizations are rewarding innovative ideas and taking proactive behaviors and helping each other out in the workplace. And so these things are also should be promotable behaviors. And we're seeing a pattern where those things are prioritized more and more.
But it seems like if you have a great idea and can inspire people like, hey, this is a great idea, you need to follow me in doing this, that's not necessarily the basis for a good manager.
That's interesting. So I would say that for the most part, getting people to follow kind of your vision requires you to share that ideal and share that vision and get that buy-in, and that would be a more effective way. But it doesn't always mean that we need to have these out-of-the-box ideas that are really kind of far off. What I really like about our field and when we talk about creativity is that the ideas have to be both novel and useful. And often when we think about creativity, we miss that usefulness part. And so when we have innovative ideas in the workplace, we're really kind of honing in on it can be out of the box and unique, but it also needs to be something that has a lot of utility for what we're trying to achieve.
We're talking about management with Kate Zappe, who's an assistant professor of management at the Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon. This month's guest in our Curious segment, Curious being Research Meets Radio. You can join the conversation on the Exchange. Questions, comments, thoughts about management and people in charge of places of work. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Kate, I noticed a lot of your research into the workplace appears to focus on what people do with their time away from the workplace. I heard the term leisure hacking applied here.
Yes. So when I started kind of developing some more recent studies, I realized that we keep on talking about employees, and doing so, we truncate their lives to this 9-to-5 window. But, you know, employees are actually people, and we live in full 24 hours a day. And so I started thinking about what happens in those hours when our work is done, and when our dishes are done too, and we just get to choose what we, how we spend our time, how does that change our attitudes and behaviors when we get back to work? And so this evolved into thinking about leisure hacking, which is, I really like the term hacking because it's this idea that we come up with more creative ways to circumvent any kind of constraints we have. And with many of our lives, time is a constraint. There's things that we want to achieve. There's things we want to get done, but we want to enjoy our free time too. And so leisure hacking helps us find ways to go about that. And so what you can think of it is that you sit down at the end of the day, you grab the remote controller, and you're deciding, do I watch the latest reality show and just veg out, or do I watch a TED Talk or listen to a podcast or something that I know would kind of help me grow and think about things in a new and different way? And so as long as it's still coming from you and what you want to do and it feels intentional in your free time, it still feels leisurely, but it's a little bit more high impact.
So it's something you can use in the workplace, in other words.
Definitely. So you can use it if you're thinking about what you want to achieve that week. You could leisure hack over the weekend to feel like when you get to work, you have more skills and you feel more kind of self-assured about what you're going to tackle in that day, or a day-to-day basis, or these little incremental times where you could leisure hack.
Very much on the employee then to figure out how to do the leisure hack, how to make use of their time away from work. But I wonder what role, if any, a manager can give beyond, for example, granting time off requests or not asking people to work late.
Yeah, so that's really one of the key ones. Something that I like to think about is what can people do when they don't have a great boss? A lot of us don't have a manager that is inspiring us to think of our jobs in different ways and really create this thriving work environment. So what's in our control? And our free time is something that's in our control. And so that's a little bit of the impetus for this idea. But certainly managers can create space where talking about the things that they did over the weekend is something safe to do so that they can share these ideas and get excited together. Managers could also kind of promote this time away from work as being totally yours and not impeding on how you use your free time, so that when you do choose to use it as a way to self-enhance or to prepare for your work, that you really feel like it's not being something that's forced on you, but something that's coming from within.
Now, just in terms of getting a little separation, too, between work and not work life, what trends do you track there? I mean, I ask because there was certainly a period of time into and during the recession when people left a lot of vacation time unused, and this idea that you're never completely separated from your email and from work and all that sort of thing seems to be still quite prevalent.
Absolutely. So a couple things are at play here. One is with technology, we are always kind of available to work in a lot of jobs. And so when we turn it off and when we turn it on is a problem. And that is still exists in the framework of kind of what I'm looking at. Of some of this is, how do we function within that? How do we create these spaces for us that feel volitional? But one of my concerns with studying leisure hacking was I wasn't sure what the negatives were. So I was thinking, what happens when we are kind of reinforcing this idea to always keep it on and not be able to turn off work? And so what I looked at was whether this is breeding some kind of work compulsivity, which is part of workaholism. And the thing is, we have these preferences. We call them segmentation preferences. But it's really, how much do you like your work and your non-work to be separate, and how much do you like it to be blended all together? So I'm a blender. I like it all mixed up. My friends are at work, and at home I do work, and I just kind of mix it all together. So for me, leisure hacking feels natural. But what I found is, for the people that really like things separate, they do not want those lines to be crossed, that something like leisure hacking can be really detrimental to their work performance.
Kate Sapay is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, an assistant professor of management at the Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon, our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. Join the conversation as we talk about management and dealing with employees and dealing with work and trying to keep them separate or not, as the case may be. 800-838-3760 to come in by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. Here's a call from John in Central Point. Welcome to the Exchange.
Thank you. Good morning.
Hi.
Yeah, just a couple comments. I was a manager for about 15 years and had quite a few supervisors that worked for me. And I had sort of three key things I looked for supervisors or managers. One was their decision-making. You know, how did they make the right decisions? They make them quickly, so forth. Two, communication, how they communicated with the people that worked for them, especially around review time. Could they be non-confrontational? Get their point across, try to separate performance from personal, you know, attacks. And three, just to be a good listener. Could they sit there and make sure their employees got across? I used to try to be real critical of myself. Did I listen to my supervisors and what they had to say? But that was it. That's just the three areas I used to mainly look for in the people that work for me.
All right, thanks for sharing the thoughts, John. Appreciate that. And how does that square up with the stuff that you have learned in your research, Kate?
Yeah, it sounds like John kind of is discovering on his own a lot that we know about the justice literature. And so I have a good stream of research there that these things, as I was jotting them down, my ideas were kind of pinging on. And so in the justice research, we find that basically, people are really sensitive to how decisions are made, whether the outcomes seem fair, inputs equal outputs. But there's a lot more that goes into that, how those decisions are communicated to people. We call that informational justice. So are you giving them enough information to understand how you make these decisions, how you came to those decisions? And then there's also interpersonal justice. So sometimes a decision seems really fair and it's communicated to you, but the way that it's told to you, you don't feel like you are allowed to give feedback or your own voice, or it's told to you in a way that feels very abrupt. And so that part of being a listener seems really salient to that, is that you're letting the other person be kind of part of these conversations. The other piece I would add is procedural justice, which is, are you following the steps in a way that everybody understands and it doesn't seem inconsistent from person to person? So I think John had a really good practice in how he went about hiring managers.
Another call here from Boris in Eugene. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Kate Sapay.
Hi, Kate. I want to talk about the Peter Principle. That was established long ago. That's the idea that when you do a good job, the only way to climb the career ladder is to move from your job up to a management job. And what it takes to do a good job, say a scientist, really doesn't have anything to do with managing people. And I was wondering, since Peter Principle came about long ago, how has that influenced your field?
All right, good question. Thanks for that, Boris.
Yeah, interesting. And so I can talk kind of broadly about kind of these hierarchies in promotion. One thing we know about leadership is what makes a leader emerge. So who gets to be promoted is different often than what makes an effective leader. And so I think that is kind of circling around this. And so it creates a kind of paradox. So, you know, we have these traits that people that are kind of politically savvy, more extroverted, so they kind of have a bigger personality, speak up more, more assertive. These are kind of traits that get people to be promoted. But what we need out of good managers aren't just those things. We need people that are kind of very deliberate in their decision making and listen to other people. And all this layered on there is exactly what Boris was talking about, that the skills that we took that initial job at are not the same that requires us to be managers. And so there's a bit of a conflict there. When I was in public accounting, I worked in auditing, but I'm a people person. I loved all these other things that we were doing besides accounting. And I had a partner one time tell me, if you can get through this accounting part of it, you'll make a great partner. And that really highlighted that disconnect where I really wasn't great at accounting, but they saw that I was going to be better once I get promoted up the ladder. So there is this difficulty in you kind of lose that core competencies, or at least they aren't as elevated because you're working with people more than you're working with your science or your Excel files or whatever this may be. And so I think that the key is to find the balance, whether it's from that employee or in the structure of the organization, that the reasons you went into that field are still feel core to who you are while you're still interacting with different levels of employees.
Okay, so like a totally disconnected from the thing that got you in there in the first place.
Right.
Another call here from Vince in Eugene. Welcome to The Exchange with Kate Zappe.
Hi there. Yes, I just wanted to make a comment and ask a question. I was in the educational field at a community college for 36 years, and the last 16 years I had the best supervisor I've ever had, a dean for our department, and she was very creative in getting us all to communicate with each other and help us listen. She had summer retreats scheduled. She even hosted parties at the holidays at her home, besides the usual department meetings and all-staff college meetings and that kind of thing. And it was a really wonderful experience. Now, I'm semi-retired, and I started working at a local department store whose name I won't mention. And I am just shocked by the poor management skills. And there's no communication, there's no creativity. And I was just wondering, is it the difference between the educational field and the business field, or are there things that retail businesses can do to get their employees more motivated to participate? The turnover at the department store is horrendous. Just wondering what you think of that.
All right. Thanks, Vince. Appreciate that.
That's interesting. One, I'm so glad you had such an amazing dean. It sounds those experiences can be really impactful for us, especially those touches that we kind of miss, that you were invited into her home, and so you could really have kind of an authentic perspective of who she is, and that's something that really helps distinguish good leaders from great leaders. Unfortunately, we don't see a lot of differences in industries. There are a lot of less inspiring leadership across all areas, including education, unfortunately. And so one thing that might be happening is that managers are kind of accustomed to this turnover. They haven't quite cultivated a workplace that people feel like they're really part of it, and they aren't sure where to begin. There are so few people that are learning the psychology side of work, either in their own time, spending time thinking about it, or taking these kind of classes. And so we just end up with a lot of people that are in leadership roles without a lot of leadership skills. One thing that I would recommend to Vince is something that we call job crafting, which is when you're kind of stuck with a leader that isn't giving you all those things that you really know that you appreciate in a job, that there are ways that you can craft your work to find those things. And so sometimes it requires doing more work or expanding it. But if you need more personal ties, reach across to a different department in your organization or find other employees or take more initiative in areas that you feel more fulfilled by, so that at least when you go home at the end of the day, you feel like there's a piece of your job that you feel really fulfilled by, despite having a less than ideal leader.
Okay, so look in places where that aren't necessarily right at your fingertips there. Kate, before we go, I wanted to ask about your experience in the mayor's office in Atlanta. You were on a project to see if government could run more like a business, which politicians talk about all the time. What'd you find out?
Yeah, so what I found is that, one, government agencies have a lot that they need to do. So I was assigned to work with different departments throughout my tenure there. So I worked with the police department for some time, water and sewer department. I worked with the fire department. And so there's a lot of moving parts here. And so there's a lot of organizations within organizations. And so I felt like this was some of the sticky parts of it, was that how do you get them to communicate with one another? How do they have their own needs that needed to be handled? How do you handle with their, deal with their own organizational structures and kind of meet them where they are? And so what I realized when I got there was that it wasn't really feeling like I was consulting with one big organization. I was consulting with 10 different organizations that needed to report to a similar audience, but they had their own structures and their own problems within each of them.
Interesting. So they weren't so much as this functioning as the city of Atlanta, but as the fire department of the city of Atlanta, the police department of the city. That's interesting.
Yeah.
All right, all kinds of stuff we could ask, but we're out of time. It's been a fun visit with Kate Sapay, an assistant professor of management in the management department at the Lundquist College of Business at the University of Oregon, our guest in this month's edition of Curious Research Meets Radio. Kate, thank you so much.
Thank you. I had a great time.
Okay, pleasure.